Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to this, the first proper Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. We heard just there, Riding with the Driver from Motorhead, because hopefully we're going to be waking up at the wheel this evening. At the start of the show, we played Hippie Hippie Shake by the Georgia Satellites, because I fancied a bit of a dance. And then we had the Phrase Mob, Under a Broken Sky, which is a tune which one of tonight's guests, Simon Spaniard, chose to put with his Welcome to the Rabbit Hole DVDs. A great tune. And great to have you here again, Simon. Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Mark Moxon, to Dr. Rock's radio show. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
It's a pleasure.
Well, we've got a good few people in the chat box by the look of it for a first night out. So there's plenty of people out there listening. Hopefully they'll put a few questions in to the maestros. But for let's start with you, Simon. For those few people out there who might never have heard of you, would you like to give us a little bit of background?
God, how long do you want me to go for? well, I guess from, you know, in previous shows, you know, with other presenters or with yourself on other radio stations, you know, about 2008, up to 2008, you know, I'd been in the banking world, started off with Coutts & Company back in 1987, ended up going into American retail banking. Basically, this is where the members of staff proactively try to drag people into the branch, sign them up for a loan, and flog them a single premium payment protection insurance on top. And come the year 2000, I kind of had enough of all of that. I ended up getting into mortgage broking. Ended up that was quite successful. Back end of 2002, early 2003, set up my own broking company. Had a couple of companies by the time 2007 came along, and of course was wiped out with the credit crunch. Changed one of my companies into a kind of claims management company, and attempted to take on some of the, you know, some of the banks that I'd actually been dealing with. And that's really how I kind of got into the whole, shall we say, the whole free thinking arena in terms of questioning what we've all come to think of as being the norm or the way things are. And that's when I really started to delve into banking, money, how money actually works, and then moved on to some of the aspects of government, the kind of foundation of our society, the way that we operate. And of course, it's, you know, it's the old adage, the more that the more you look, the more you find. And of course, things then begin to not necessarily make sense in the context of what we're used to, but they begin to make sense in a way that, you know, we'd never necessarily contemplated before. And in fact, they tend to make more sense once you're actually seeing things with clear eyes or new eyes. Things begin to make more sense as opposed to, you know, what we've all been brought up to believe in and go along.
Which is clearly entirely mysterious if you start thinking about it. What we're actually told doesn't make any sense at all. How much of a, I mean, you've been in the trade for 15, 16, 17 years when you started to realise that maybe things were a bit all right. How much of a surprise to you was it?
In terms of, well, let's put it this way. I mean, in terms of money, you know, having worked in banking for all those years and finance, you know, I really did not actually understand how money and currency truly worked.
No, I
didn't have a, you know, blinded by, you know, blinded by all of it, being in it. You know, I didn't see the wood for the trees, as it were. You know, we all have our kind of understanding of money. You know, we think we take those notes out of our wallets, we hand them over, and we can obtain stuff. And that's pretty much probably the limit or the maximum that people think about money. And it's just so much more than that. And, you know, we were talking a little bit before the show, and I said, well, you know, look, if we changed the monetary system and we stopped using debt as money, I figure that everybody could actually have an additional 2.5 weeks holiday. And I don't believe we'd be, in fact, I think we'd be better off.
Yeah, Yeah, that sounds about right to me. And we'll be looking into some of just how the money does work in a short while, hopefully. But Mark, what brought you into contact with this our Buccaneer friend here?
Well, you need to go back a bit. I'm an engineer by training and trade and that sort of thing. Also a businessman as well, an entrepreneur, you might say. As an engineer, you always look for things that work. Now, the other side of things that interest me is health. I've been a natural health follower and practicer for 40-odd years, I suppose, in so many ways. And I would say quite a successful one. I've not been to see a doctor for any type of illness or anything like that for, you know, at least 40 years, I should say. So I do try and practice what I preach, which I think is probably a good idea. But if you like, the engineering part, of the way that interfaces with the engineering side is that I want solutions that work.
Yeah.
As an engineer, you can't build a bridge that's going to fail. Well, some do, but you shouldn't.
Yeah.
You can't put brakes on a vehicle that don't work. It sort of tends to get a bit squeaky after a while.
Yeah. Don't get you a good name, does it?
It doesn't, no. So from that point of view, I want things that work. And when a long time ago, I was about 16, I think, my mum went in for an operation on her hip. And she had it done privately at the Wellesley Hospital, I think it was, in Southend. And she came home, and within a few days, she was in intense pain. And what happened was the metal cage that they put around the top of the hip joint to keep the muscles in place had disengaged, and her hip, or rather her leg bone, was about 6 inches up past where it should be.
Oh.
And one of the clearest memories I've got is sat in the back of the car with my dad, the tears in his eyes, driving back to the hospital because he just didn't know what to do with mum. She didn't know what to do with herself. And I was sat in the back thinking, this isn't right. She put her trust in somebody to make her better, and they've let her down.
Yeah.
That got me onto the path of finding out about natural health, because the thought I had in my mind at the time was, I'm not going to let anybody do this to me.
Yeah.
As much as I can, I'm not going to let anybody do it to anybody else. So that set me on a path to find out about natural health, about how the body worked, really to help me steer clear of the conventional medical way of doing things, because I could see it clearly wasn't working in so many ways. And I think once you start looking at the way things are done conventionally, and you start seeing holes in one area, which I was seeing in the medical profession, your eyes become more and more open to how those same slack standards, those same commercial lies appear in other areas.
Yes.
And I've always, if you like, I've always had a fairly open mind about what's going on around me. I always ask the question, well, why? And I think after a few years that came into, well, who's making the money here?
Yeah.
And that very, very quickly came onto a little catchphrase of mine. When someone says, well, what's going on here? I say, follow the money. See who's making the money and you'll find out.
Yeah.
And I think as time went forward, you become more and more exposed to the alternative way of doing things, if I can call it that. And that leads you into finding or talking with different people, finding out about different things, and your whole horizon broadens. And then you end up meeting people like the lovely Simon here.
Yes, indeed. It's funny, isn't it, how each change that you make, each thing that you realise, actually changes everything else that you know. So the process of discovery is actually a lot faster than just one thing at a time.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And I agree entirely with follow the money. It's one of the things, we were talking about when we were off air, is that when push comes to shove, it all comes down to the money, which is why following the money helps to tell you what's going on. And it's why I'm pretty sure that your new website, youandyourcash.com, is going to prove to be incredibly useful. What did you have in mind when you set it up? What was your basic mission idea?
Well, I mean, for the past, let's put it this way, before I kind of bumped into Mark, you know, I'd been wanting to set up a website, but I didn't have the know-how, I didn't have the skills to do it myself. And, you know, a lot of people had offered help. But obviously, the pressures of daily life being what they are, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people that were offering help were involved in their own court cases, or court cases just seemed to come out of the woodwork and then snatch them away from me. And so I spent maybe a frustrating 4 years, you know, toying with the idea of having a website. Then, you know, Mark joined the email list one day and basically mentioned what he did and said, well, you know, look, if you need any help, let me know. And I went straight back and said, well, actually, yeah, I could do some based. And it turned out that he was literally just 8 to 12 miles away. And I thought, okay, right, well, that's great. So Mark actually, you know, I said to Mark, look, I want to set up a website. And he said, well, no, I'm not going to do it for you. I'll come round and I'll show you how to do it so that you don't need to keep relying on me. I'll teach you how to build one. And that was it. And so that was about, what, 18 months ago, something like that?
Yeah.
It was about 18 months ago. And, you know, that was great. I had a nice tinkering around with the website. And I've since, you know, taken that back down and now put it back up. And I've changed the, you know, the entire style with Mark's help. But it's nice to be empowered in that way. And we kind of got talking. And, you know, Mark had seen what I was doing, and I'd given Mark some complimentary DVDs, the three DVDs of which you know you've seen yourself, Doc.
Oh yes, they're great, folks. Get them now.
Well, you know, I've tried to make them, shall we say, as professional as possible. But then, you know, I did the mortgage seminar back in November last year, and Mark filmed it, and basically Mark said to me, he said, "Well, look, you know, you're trying to sort of." You're trying to keep things going in a way that is not necessarily optimum, and also you're presenting a lot of information which is kind of blowing people's brains, and there's potentially a better way of doing it.
Yeah.
And it was Mark's expertise, really, in terms of pointing out, I mean, it's, you know, potentially it's always the simple way of doing things makes sense, but sometimes we're so clouded we don't see it. And you know, Mark just pointed out a few simple truths, and I just thought, well, you know what? With what Mark was proposing, and with Mark's expertise anyway, because, you know, Mark takes care of a lot of the technical side of things, which means that I pretty much just have to turn up and do some turn up and talk. You know, and obviously, talking is one of my fortes. So,
is it?
Well, yeah. So that was it. And Mark, you know, presented to me a way of actually presenting the information, which should bring clarity to a lot of people out there. And of course, my desire was to try to open up the eyes and the minds of what I'm going to call the mainstream. I mean, obviously, yeah. You know, I've been known perhaps for the last 4 to 8 years for being in what is maybe a fringe or alternate scene, as it were, of free thinkers that debate and freely debate and openly debate, you know, different aspects of law, banking, society, and things like that. And so I thought, right, okay, it certainly got me thinking in a new way. And I think with what we've got planned, and it's very embryonic at the moment, it only went live, 5th of March this year, it's very embryonic, but already I can sense that a lot of the ideas we've been bouncing around and a lot of the plans that we've actually got for the site should actually enable a lot of people that need to be, shall we say, cuddled and gently coerced looking at things. It should be really kind of for those people, but also for people that are, you know, well and truly rooted in alternate viewpoints and in the alternate scene, as it were.
Yeah.
And I just like the whole overall feel of it. There's a lot more clarity.
Yeah,
I think so. I also think people are going to be able to learn more easily from it, because the format you've chosen, which is getting people to send you questions and then having a little meeting over the coffee table and filming the resulting 10 or 12 minutes of useful information, it works really well. I mean, I personally don't hold with this idea that people can only concentrate for 15 minutes, but I think with this complex information, it's probably better done your way. And you look like you're having a good time doing it between you as well.
No, we do, don't we? We have quite a giggle.
We have a nice chat beforehand, cup of tea and stuff like that. We get on really well, and I think we bounce off. I think with our experience, combined experience, I think we bounce off each other quite well. And Mark's getting well and truly into research. In fact, he's actually writing a paper on speeding tickets, aren't you? At the moment?
Yes, yes.
It really is something. I mean, for me myself, this way of doing things really ticked a number of boxes for me, because I like doing research. Obviously we have to try and, although it's not at the moment, we have to try to look to support ourselves in some way, shape or form, but we have to make that accessible and fair to everybody. And, this ticks all of the boxes for me. And we have fun, and it's educational, and it's very simple and clear, I hope. And it emphasises the point that there's more than one solution for every problem out there.
And the more people that get involved with the solutions, the more solutions there'll be, because problem tends to be uniquely crafted to each individual, so their solution is probably going to have to be uniquely crafted too.
True. And I think the way in which we present it actually makes it more accessible to people. They can actually relate to it and identify with the actual problem.
Yeah.
As opposed to reeling off and giving like a 4-hour seminar and spiel about the inner workings, for example, of, XYZ section of law or this or that and the other, and, having a whole host of information to try to digest and process. Splitting it into, as Mark said, one problem, one solution. It just makes it more accessible to people, and and will hopefully encourage or inspire people out there to perhaps dig a little bit deeper and maybe find solutions for themselves.
Yeah, and it was that accessibility that we were trying to really dive into, because we realised there are a lot of people in, I'll use the term, the Freeman movement, those who've had their eyes opened, who know about these solutions, may not fully understand them. As time goes on, they obviously will. But there are probably 10, 100 times more people who need the same solutions but might be put off by the reputation that the Freeman movement is often given by the powers that be. So we thought we'd cut straight through that and we'd make it accessible for, the everyday Joe in the street to say, well, actually, what they're saying sounds quite reasonable. It sounds like something I can use myself. Because we're just presenting, as Simon said, one problem, one solution. Plus, of course, the all-important help sheets that people can download free from the site that take things a little bit further in almost a step-by-step manner. And Simon puts a lot of effort into doing these to make them as accessible as possible.
Well, I think one of the grand things about those is that having watched the little videos, you can there's enough information on the fact sheets to help you go and start doing your own research, your own due diligence into whichever of the subjects grabs you foremost, which I think that's another important thing, because there's 1,000 different sorts of Freeman, aren't there? And a lot of them are finding themselves doing a little bit of time or one thing and paying fines, one thing and the other. So it's... It's, I think, really good that people can be given the chance of picking their way through the mass of data that's on the internet, because it's very difficult to say what's right and what's wrong. And your basic solution, which I really love, is to acknowledge that the system is basically there to take money off us. And one of the things your website seems to be aiming at is helping people to maybe consider preventing them from doing that.
Oh, indeed, yeah. That not only... not allowing the system to take money off you when it shouldn't, but also allowing people to understand how the system does it, how it entraps them, but more importantly, how they can walk around the traps.
Well, and identify the traps in the first place, because a lot of these things are so hidden and people are blind to it, and it's only when you kind of point out the elephant sitting in the corner that some people actually say, oh my God, yes, there is an elephant sitting in the corner. It is really that kind of situation, because I think a lot of us are going to understand, probably us three certainly will understand, that once you see it, it's just like, oh my God, it was hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
It was right in front of my eyes and I didn't see it. And it really is that kind of eureka moment when you suddenly realize that all is not as you thought it was. And of course, I'm sure lots of people have those kind of revelational moments when they're, you know, when they're starting to delve into the inner workings of what we call the system.
There's a lot of respect. Sorry to talk over you. There's a lot of respect, mutual respect. And because we are so different in many ways, but so similar in others, we do spark off each other quite nicely, don't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a nice combination there, you know. I've learned a lot from Mark. Let's put it this way. I've learned a lot from Mark because of his business expertise, and also his expertise because he's a renowned author, aren't you? And of course, you know, for someone like myself who's wanting to put information out, and I mean, the number of times I've tried to write a book, it's ridiculous. But Mark very quickly just explained to me, you know, a simple technique for doing it. And I was just like, oh my God, obviously I'm not going to reveal that technique, but it's just like, oh my God, that seems really simple. And of course I've started on that. So in terms of assisting me to actually express myself and get information out, it's been wonderful for me, you know, it really has. I think we complement each other really well.
Yeah,
I'd like to think so.
I think it's another useful point to bear in mind is that this sort of work is actually always better, it's always easier done in teams. And I think that to a certain extent, we don't get to understand what we really think until we start passing it by somebody else, you know, who's capable of discussing it with us.
That's very true. And one of the things we did right early on was sit down and decide what we wanted to achieve out of this, so that there were no surprises in the future. Because so many times you get into a business relationship with somebody, one person's got one idea, another person's got one idea. You're both caught up with the newness of it, but down the line, one person's expectation doesn't match the other's. And having seen that before, we thought it was best to actually sit down, and we actually took quite a long time, didn't we? Sort of just mulling over things, or, you know, this is what I'd like to see, and Simon would say, this is what I'd like to see. And the good thing was, most of those points correlated. You know, they were, I should think, a good 85% of the different things that we wanted to see the business do were there for both of us. And one of the main things is that, you know, Simon said earlier, whatever you do, you've got to eat. There's always a need for us to have a roof over our heads, food on the table, and the other sort of necessities of life. Yet when you've got a heart that wants to help other people, sometimes those things get pushed back. And having seen that many times in, I'll say, good actions of charities and things like that, where they eventually fold because there's no support mechanism, there's nothing providing the necessary finance, the support, and the things that make it easy for people in those organisations to do their jobs. We wanted to avoid that. So, if you like, our basic premise is that we can help the people who need the help, who can't afford the help, by making a very reasonable charge on those who also need help and can afford the help.
Yeah. And is that working?
Well, early, I mean, early days. It's early days at the moment. But then again, you know, I think Mark has kind of tried and tested this in other arenas. So, you know, it was really a case of, you know, I mean, I've operated my own businesses before, and you know, I don't want business, you know, busyness. I don't want business to be a dirty word, you know, out there. You know, it really is a situation that, you know, I've tried over the past, well, where are we? I've tried since I got into this. I've tried to, you know, I've assisted people, and it's really difficult. Let me give you a simple example. You know, if somebody turns up and says, "Si, here's a whole bundle of folders, and I want you to work them for me for nothing." Well, what they're really saying to me is, "I want you to work them for me, and I want you to donate not only your time but also all the monies that it costs to phone up these companies, send send letters to them, which is ink, electricity to type the things up, paper to print it on, envelopes to send it in, postage, stamps to put on the envelope, petrol to get me down to the post office, and so on and so forth." So what they're really asking me to do is actually donate my time and money to sort their problems out. And that doesn't work long when you've got nothing to support you. You know, I mean, this may come as a surprise, but the inheritance that I was due to get Let's touch wood. My mum hasn't popped her clogs yet, but she gave it to me in advance. I've actually spent, believe it or not, nearly £100,000 supporting myself to actually assist other people over the last, well, since 2008.
Yeah.
Now, that might come as a surprise to a few people out there, but that's what I've done. And yes, I have been supported by, like, in that way. But I've also supported myself because, of course, you know, I ask for contributions at seminars and this, that and the other while I'm traveling around. And I like to think it's a kind of ethos that I brought forward from my days in banking. I may not have been the best salesman, but I would certainly be the most dedicated. So I used to be there before everyone got in, and I would be there after everyone had gone. And, you know, people thought that I pretty much lived at work. And I kind of did, really, because I used to get warnings not to work so many hours.
Yeah.
You know, so, but the point is, that I'm trying to make is that, you know, we have to, in order to help other people, you have to help yourself first and be in a stable situation so that you are best placed to assist other people.
Yeah.
That's where you're going to get your optimum results from. And I think what we're trying to achieve is not charge the earth. We're trying to make everything accessible. So, you know, you've got prices from, like, I mean, things start off at free. Starts off free and it works its way up depending on the level of assistance or the level of intricacy that people want. But the majority of solutions are going to be, you know, 49p or 99p and we're, you know, or £1.99. And we're hoping that, you know, sheer numbers and the interest is going to actually enable us to offer, really, for want of a better word, the service where you provide us with the problem, we'll do all the research, we'll put it together, we'll make it hopefully understandable and easily accessible, we'll create templates where possible, and then we'll roll it out for you. And so, you know, I kind of look at it in, from that point of view, from that perspective, people are effectively paying us a very small amount, contribution, to do all of their legwork for them, and produce something which they can understand very quickly and put into use and put into practice very, very quickly.
And get results.
And hopefully get results, yeah.
Yeah. I think this is something else. I think we've probably talked about this before in years gone by, Simon, that there is another, seems to be another strange characteristic of the Freeman movement, is that you get into trouble for what they call selling information, but they don't realise that it's not the bloody information that you're selling, as you say, it's your time.
You know, well, the information's all out there. I mean, where do you think I got the information from?
Right, yeah, but this, I mean, how long does it take you to find it? That's the thing.
Well, you have to do reading, you have to do digging, and this, that, and the other. And also, you have to not only just take on board the information, but you have to then process it, and then you have to contemplate it and play with it. Because, you know, look, it's, you know, how many ways are there to score a goal in football? You know, there's a gazillion ways when you actually think about it, because the build-up can be slightly different from all the other build-ups, and then the way that you put it into the net can be slightly different from all the other ways you put it into the net. But, you know, ultimately, a goal is a goal. And what we're aiming for is we're aiming for results, and we're aiming to get the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah.
Now, there are lots and lots of solutions. The information is out there, okay? You go to libraries, you know, there's law books galore. The problem is, and this is something I mentioned at the seminar in November, which was the mortgage seminar, the problem that people encounter, and I think the frustrations that actually people are dealing with, is that the information is there, but they can't apply it.
Mm.
And that comes down to, you know, information is one thing, the strategy of how to use it and how to apply it, or the confidence to create a strategy and try it, right? Test it on yourself as a guinea pig. Having that confidence, not many people have got that confidence, and a lot of people want reassurance that whatever they do is going to work. They want a guarantee. But there are no guarantees in this life, right? You've got to be prepared to roll with the punches, okay? And, you know, I guess one thing that I've got, I suppose, you know, in my favour is that I've got kind of boundless confidence, and I'll give it, if I see that something should work or could work, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's selling out, because I mean, here's a challenge for people out there, okay? For those parties that believe everything should be free to them, and a lot of the time the parties who want it free are actually working,
yeah,
and can't be bothered to do the work themselves. So they want someone else to do all the work for them and then present it and sometimes do it for them for nothing. Well, I challenge those people to show me how that works. Show me how, because if you can show me how that all works and I'm able to eat at the end of the day, having put in however many hours work and research and this, that and the other, where normally I'd be going out to do a job, in which case I wouldn't be able to do this, then you explain it to me bit by bit, piece by piece, step by step, how that works. Because they won't be able to, because it doesn't work. And so if you want longevity, okay, you've got to have some kind of support system. And then, you know, and so we're trying to make the support system for ourselves as fair as possible, yeah, so that we can support other people.
The important message is, isn't it? Because although what we're probably going to be saying about cash might make people think that it's completely not important at all, to us, the actual flowing of these notes through our hands is what keeps the whole thing, what keeps the whole thing rolling at the moment. Like everybody else, we need to have some money. But it's bizarre, isn't it, that the thing we're using to do that is such a worthless scrap of paper.
Well, it's a worthless scrap of paper. Let's put it this way, you know, I mean, money, what is money? You know, I mean, we have these things, money of substance, which was gold or silver typically, that we would think of. Many things have served the purpose of money. Beads, seed, ice.
Chocolate beans. Chocolate beans.
Just ice, yeah. That's, well, think about it. Just ice, justice. And, you know, that's the currency of the court system. And, you know, all these things, we've had money of exchange, which is paper, and we have money of account, which is digits. But of means hailing from. So money can hail from all of those three things. So what is money? Well, as far as I'm concerned, money's a concept.
It's
whatever you want it to be. I mean, it's money or money's worth. It's kind of the same thing. It's, if people see value in something, well, then they're prepared to exchange it. It's just that money is readily, what we conceive as being money is just something that's readily exchangeable and recognized as being readily exchangeable, and therefore people will accept it because they know they can get rid of it and pass it on. And therefore money oils the wheels, right? Money makes the world go round. So the problem is that, of course, the pieces of paper that we're passing round, albeit the fact that those pieces of paper cost a fraction of a penny to produce by the private bank that produced them, we pay for those bits of paper at face value plus interest. And we pay for that in time, right? So we spend time and we burn energy in order to pay back the face value plus interest of those bits of paper. But if we issued bits of paper, let's say we all need bits of paper. That's fair enough. We need something to pass around to show the love, right? And to show that there's been an exchange. Fair enough. That's not a problem. But if those bits of paper were issued by the people of the people for the people, they don't have to be paid back. And that mere fact that we don't have to pay them back would give us an additional 2.5 weeks holiday per month and the best standard of living on the planet.
And
that's my bold statement.
Yeah, and that would be just the start of the effects of such a manoeuvre.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, because, of course, you know, you've got in the press, you know, I think, you know, work, going to work, apparently work actually creates an enormous amount of stress for people. I mean, I don't know why the Health and Safety Executive haven't got onto that one, because really work should be banned, I guess. But if we look at, I mean, let's look at the progress that we've made in the Western civilization, right? You've got tribal people, and I appreciate they live in mud huts, but we've got technology. We don't have to live in mud huts. But tribal peoples work on average 4 hours a day. We, following all the years of progress, yeah, right, and technology, because remember, technology and computers were supposed to actually reduce our working day. Well, in actual fact, what's happened is we've had to, the converse has happened. We're now attempting as people to try and work as fast as computers, which is pretty impossible. So we're trying to work as fast as computers, and we're now working longer hours because we can't work as fast as computers and the technology, but we're having to try and keep up. So therefore, we compensate for that by working longer.
Yeah.
And because of inflation and that a hidden tax, and because of the way things have worked out with regards to the monetary system and the effects that's had on us all, of course we have to work longer because, of course, our salary, the pounds that we have in our wallet, isn't worth as much as it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago and 50 years ago. It just doesn't make sense. How can this be progress? We shouldn't necessarily be spending our entire lives working, you know, because otherwise, I mean, what on earth did we come here for?
Yeah, indeed.
What, to slave away and then die?
Yeah. And it is bizarre. It's especially bizarre, isn't it? Because you make it quite clear that before we repay all this money to the banks, we've actually given it to them in the first place. So we're giving it to them twice.
Well, let's put it this way, right? Look, think of it. We spend our time, don't we, working to obtain their currency. And we want lots of their currency. Well, why? Well, because we want as much currency as possible so that we could potentially retire early or we can buy time. But we started off with the time in the first place, right? And we've effectively washed it through their currency and it's come out a lot less. It shrunk in the wash, right? Time has shrunk in the wash. So we have to question what we're doing with our time, and we also have to question why. Why are we doing this with our time? Well, there's a very simple answer. It's because of taxation and the way that the monetary system works. And we only have to cast our eyes towards Iceland to see what they've done in very recent years in terms of, you know, arresting dodgy bankers and sacking dodgy politicians who were in cahoots with those bankers in order to see that the people... I mean, apparently Iceland is now one of the most prosperous countries in the whole of Europe.
It is.
Have you
been... So why aren't we following... You know, you don't follow the practices of someone that loses. For example, you know, I used to play for a football team called Chalkwall United. Over 35s, right? Some of the players would be smoking at half time, right? And we were second from bottom in the entire Football Association League, right? I mean, you know, it was comical.
Second from bottom, right?
So, you know, I mean, it was for a laugh more than anything. Now, if you're going to create a football team and you're serious about it, do you reckon you'd come down to Chalkwell United and watch what we do? Or would you go along to somewhere like Arsenal? Well, not Arsenal this year, but let's go Leicester then, you know, this year, and go and see how they do things. You mimic those traits and those practices and those behaviours which are successful and bring success.
Yeah.
You don't mimic the behaviours which bring failure. So why aren't we copying Iceland?
So why aren't we copying Iceland, Si?
Exactly. Why aren't we?
Somebody must have something to lose if we do that.
Yeah. Starts with a B, ends with an S. Bankers.
And the inflation itself, I gather, is a product of the banking system. One of the things I discovered fairly recently was that we didn't used to have that. That kind of between 1810 and 1910, your dollar would have bought you about as much bread over there from the beginning to the end of those 100 years, but that our inflation arose as a result of the need to raise taxes to pay the interest on the money that we've already given them that they're lending to us. Is that right?
All I remember hearing when I was kind of growing up was how we needed, maybe up to 3% inflation because that encouraged growth. Now, that doesn't. As far as I'm concerned, that 3% inflation is another tax.
Yeah.
It's just another tax. You know, at the end of the day, someone makes a decision to increase prices, right?
Yeah. Well, do they? Well,
there you go. There's your inflation. And also, you know, look, I've looked at a number of government reports, and you have to question the integrity of some of these reports because, you know, on some, I'll have to present these one day. On some reports, I've looked at, page one will have one set of figures for a certain category, and you go through a few pages and the same category's got a different figure. Now that's the integrity of that report.
Yeah.
Right? It seems as if it's almost as if it's made up.
Almost, yeah. You know? Almost as if.
Right, strangely enough.
Yeah.
But you know, when it comes down to the monetary system, you know, unfortunately there are absolutely, if you search on Google, anyone who searches on Google, there are hundreds of quotes from well-known respected people throughout the ages who tell of the and forewarn of the problems with regards to the monetary system. And even the word money itself, the etymology, one meaning of it was warning.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. Do you think someone was trying to tell us something?
Well, like you say, it is always hidden in plain sight, isn't it?
It is. And they've been trying to tell us the truth for, you know, decades, centuries even. But, you know, it doesn't suit people to listen.
No, I'm
more comfortable just following the crowd, and the crowd goes where it's told. So you and the people telling the crowd to go where they're told to go are the ones who are making the money out of what that crowd does.
Yeah,
follow the money.
Qui bono? Who benefits?
Yes. Yeah, indeed. We've got a question from the chat box. We have from Patrick. He's saying, is Simon of the same opinion as me that it's our signature that creates the money and that they don't lend us money but facilitate credit?
If we're talking about loans and credit cards, then yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's the signature coupled with the deposit of the security that actually, which is treated as cash for accounting purposes. So in effect, when you deposit a credit agreement, you are in fact depositing an instrument which is treated as cash for accounting purposes. Okay, because in effect, you think that credit agreement is an agreement to pay money, which is basically has the same effect as a promise to pay money. In other words, money is going to be moving from one position to another. And therefore, that's treated as cash for accounting purposes. So who loans who the cash? Well, you have to hand that credit agreement or security back to the bank before they will extend anything to you. The reality is, the flip side of that coin is, they can't extend anything to you until you make that deposit. And it is a deposit.
Yeah, because they cannot lend depositors money, can they?
No, they can't. And so, you know, they have to get the entries from somewhere. Now, funnily enough, I actually managed to obtain two internal statements, print-offs, or screen dumps, as we used to call them in the industry. You just take the screen and you print it off. And the statements that people get sent to them are vastly different from the internal screen dumps of what's gone on an account. Because the first few transactions are omitted from your statements, which are put on nice headed paper.
Hmm.
And the entries that are omitted are the acceptances. It's normally phrased acceptance. And that's where the credit agreement goes into the account as cash. At the very, very day one, I've actually got that from Bank of Scotland, two internal Bank of Scotland printouts, one with Sainsbury's Bank. I can't remember who the other one. I think the other one was Halifax Bank of Scotland. I think it was a Halifax account, actually. And it shows it clearly. It shows it clearly. So they are misrepresenting the situation because the statements that I've been sent separately, and these internal printouts came from barristers, funnily enough, when they disclosed to me in two court cases. This wasn't on the statement that the company sent me. It just shows it clearly. And once you kind of resonate with that, and once people understand that, because I appreciate some people out there might think that that sounds a little bit alien to them. But once you fully understand how it works, and once you fully understand what is treated as cash, right, bit of paper with a signature on, it begins to make sense. It takes a while, but it begins to make sense, and it becomes very obvious.
But Dave said it, didn't he? He said that a promissory note is treated as cash, and a promissory note is basically your signature on a piece of paper that says, I promise to pay.
Yeah, or indeed an inchoate instrument, isn't it? Just the signature on a piece of paper.
Yeah, yeah. Just the signature, Section 20, Bill of Exchange Act 1882, inchoate instruments.
That shows you what the actual valuable thing on the credit agreement is. It's the signature that's crucial, because you could have everything else on there and not the signature, and it wouldn't work at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's the signature which gives credibility to the document. Without your signature, it doesn't make the piece of paper real, as it were, or what's on the piece of paper real.
Yeah, which is why you find more and more that official pieces of paper aren't signed anymore. They're just stamped or photocopied with a signature.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's just a squiggle, which says, you know, Department of whatever.
Mm.
That's because I think that many people working in these places know that what they're doing is not legal, and they just don't want to take responsibility for it by signing the paper.
Exactly right. And if you try and get them to sign anything, then they will pretty quickly go scuttling, I think. If in the absence of gold, then, because we never get to see any of the gold, doesn't that make our signatures the things that back the whole currency?
Well, I think you know, ultimately there's something really valuable that we don't really see. Again, it's hidden in plain sight, and that's our energy and our time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, think about it. You know, you have a certain amount of time. Each of us has a certain amount of time. We don't know when that time is up, but we have a certain amount of time. That time is priceless. It's limited. It's priceless, right? But the second thing is, our energy is also, as far as I'm concerned, it's also priceless because of what we can do with it. And, you know, ultimately, it's just like anything. You put your energy into something, you give it credence, you give it power, you can create things, and, you know, ultimately you can gain value from what you've done, even if it's a case whereby, you know, depending on how you consider value, And I think what we've got, I think we've got the measurement of value completely wrong. And I think that's half the problem. We consider value to be a number. Most people consider, if you want to compare, you know, go to the shop, you want to compare a pair of trainers with a tracksuit top, you're going to look at the value of that, right? You know, obviously some people go for branded things, which are maybe 800. And other people go for something that's not branded, which is maybe 50. Let's talk about a pair of trainers, for example. And that's how people measure value. But that's the wrong measurement. It's the wrong measurement. And I think what we have to do, I was thinking this, you know, the other day when I was kind of, you know, I've thought up, I've got a few ideas for different monetary systems. And I thought, well, if you really have to have double entry accounting, okay, for example, what about a monetary system that was based on the goodwill of the people, right? Goodwill is an asset. Now, goodwill, if you've got a debit entry, which is the asset, that automatically creates the credit entry, right?
Yeah.
So you spend the credit entry and you put that into the economy. But from where that's come from, because it's come from, if you like, a positive as opposed to a negative, which is debt, treating debt being handled as money or being treated as money, because it comes from a positive entry, right, goodwill, you'd think that, well, okay, well, once that money's been spent, once that credit's been extended, you have to then decrease the goodwill figure on the debit side of the ledger. Well, not necessarily, because of the way that things are actually operating, by putting that credit entry out into the economy, you could actually increase the goodwill. So although you've actually spent the credit entry, that's actually increased the debit entry. So now you've just got another money pot ready to spend again. Because the goodwill of the, you know, the measure of goodwill among the people would increase. Now, I've given a very brief précis of what my idea was and how that would kind of work, and I've made it very simplified. But the fact, the point is, the measure, what we are actually measuring, you know, we should be placing more value on ourselves, on other people, on what we do, the decisions that we make, and on our time.
Yeah, but in order to, I guess in order to do that, we do need to understand what the money is and how it works, because if we want our time back, effectively, we've got to prevent our money from being taken from us.
Indeed, yeah. Mm.
Because, like you say, it's between, I think, I've seen 65% as a low number. The highest number I think I've seen is 80% of our income being taken off us in tax.
It goes as high as 87% in some places.
Does it really?
Yeah. You know, and if you think about it, if the government's very generous, they let you keep 13% of what you've actually sweated to earn. That, to my mind, is extortion. If a non-governmental person did that, they would be arrested for all sorts of things, you know, fraud, coercion. They'd probably be expected to be part of the mafia or something like that.
Yeah.
In fact, the mafia let you keep more than that.
We've got a couple of questions from the chat box, and then I reckon we should probably have a couple of tunes and a refreshment break, if you're all right with that.
Yeah, cool.
Very good. We've got the first one comes from Mithrin, and it says, Michael Tallinger claim that there's a group in Ireland who successfully discharged 6 million, presumably euros, in debts with promissory notes. Have the guests heard anything about this?
The short answer is no.
Okay.
Haven't.
That's a simple one. I know that Michael Tellinger's been playing with promissory notes for some time, but I've not yet actually seen any evidence of whether it's worked for him or not. Same's true of a lot of other Michael Tellinger's work, actually. And one from Rob Freeman says, question, does Simon agree that the word price has been switched for the word value, and as such, prices can ever be artificially increased?
Interesting. I mean, obviously, value is a kind of, is this the right word, subjective concept? It's personal to everyone, right? Everyone's got their own perspective on value. But then again, people can be led to believe that something's got value because it's got a price written on it. But think of the word price, prize. What are they prizing from you?
That's true. Well, on that note, I think we'll slip over and have a quick listen to Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra and Money Isn't Everything, and perhaps another tune after that. And we'll come back to you in about 7 or 8 minutes. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, where I'm talking to Mark and Simon about cash. And we'll be back with you soon. Thanks for being there, gentlemen.
Pleasure.
Kidnap Alice, and we're going where the chilly winds don't blow. Yeah, well, Hopefully so. Well, Simon and Mark, welcome back to part two of the show. Before we move on to think a little bit about tax, insurance and mortgages, I just want to revisit this business of the bank loans, because I'm thinking that if we give them a note which is cash against which they lend us a load of money which we then pay back to them, where did all the money go? Under those circumstances, you thought it'd be quite difficult to end up with no money.
Well, look, but you see, there's a difference between cash and money.
Great.
See, I think of cash as a promise to pay money.
Yeah.
So if you're going to give another promissory note, that's cash.
Yeah.
That's another promise to pay money. So they've now got two promises to pay money, but they haven't got the money. So what's money?
In the absence of gold.
Some people say that time is money.
Yeah.
Right? So the point is, you've got to understand let's put it this way. Let me break this down, because I always have so many things flying through my brain, and my problem is that my mouth doesn't necessarily go as quickly, or my brain doesn't slow down so that my mouth can catch up. So on the one hand, think of it like this, and it's something I raised at the seminar in November. If NatWest, you do a deal with NatWest, right? You go and get a £10,000 loan, they've got a 10 grand document, you've gone and spent the money. Oh, sorry, the digits, right? You've gone and spent the currency.
Yeah.
So that's got to be paid back. But let's say that NatWest sell that document on to Barclays Bank, right?
Yeah.
And you merrily pay back NatWest, right? The original company, you pay them the interest and you're paid. You're square, you're done, right? But they don't give you the document back. And Barclays, in turn, sells that on to somebody else, who sells it on to somebody else, and on and on and on and on we go. What does the 20th bank do with that document, and why would they want that document?
Well, they use it exactly the same as everybody else.
Well, perhaps they're using it in the way that, you know, they're using it to boost their balance sheet, or maybe they're collecting in some other way, because they don't come and knock on your door to collect again, because you'd realize, right, if you've already paid NatWest plus the interest, you'd know about it if someone knocked on your door trying to collect the same loan that you've already paid off, right?
Yeah.
So what are the banks doing with that paper? Could it be that there's a different intention? And I don't know the answer to this, I'm just, you know, shooting the breeze, but could it be that there's a different intention to the underlying basis of the system? And I'll come up with a hypothesis in a minute. And is it that maybe the banks are collecting on those notes in a different way, right? Because as long as they get credit for those notes, what do they care? As long as they can go spend the currency, what do they care? They don't. But they've got to be able to exchange that note for currency that they can spend, right?
Yeah.
Right. So that's the first thing. Now, in terms of, where was I? I don't want to lose myself. Where was I actually? So what are they doing with that note, right?
We were looking at the 20th bank with the note.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the thing is, you're talking about, you know, if someone's going to be paying off an outstanding debt with a promissory note, well, I guess the reasons in many cases that they don't want to accept that promissory note, albeit the fact that the memorandum and articles of association is going to say that they can process, you know, bills, drafts, notes, and so on and so forth. You know, effectively, they've got two promises to pay money, right? So what's the hypothesis on why they want those bits of paper and they're not going to give the bits of paper back? And what are they doing with those bits of paper? Well, on the one hand, holding the piece of paper itself demonstrates that it hasn't been redeemed, right? Bought back. So when you paid your loan off, you didn't redeem the note, the security.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we all want redemption, really, don't we?
We do.
Right. Okay, so that's the first thing. But the second thing is that, you know, banks are able to offset unpaid debt against tax. Now, the fact that, put it this way, if I'm holding the loan agreement in my hand, yes or no, is that proof in itself that it hasn't been redeemed?
Well, no.
Anybody not asking deeper questions, yes.
It is. It's proof in itself that it hasn't been bought back because I've got it.
Yeah.
So therefore, if I've got it, I could potentially say, well, hold on, I've got a bad debt here. It hasn't been redeemed. I need to offset this against tax.
So none of the debts are being redeemed? Because nobody's getting their notes back.
Well, who goes to redeem their securities? Mm. Most people don't even want to see that thing again because they associate it with debt.
Yeah, and not only that, they don't appreciate how valuable it is.
And was it ever the habit to give these things back to people?
Yes, I remember doing that way back when.
Well, if you go back even further than your way back when, if you gave somebody an IOU, when you paid them back, you expected the IOU back. Because that IOU can be transferred between people.
Yeah, your IOU is a promise to pay. And I remember when cheques used to get sent back once they'd done their job.
Well, I remember working at Coutts back in 1987, and we used to send all the cheques that had passed through the system, we sent them back with the statements to the customers. Now, the point is, let's put it this way, right? If you go to a pawnbroker and you want to borrow some money, or you want, you put something in, it's held as security and they give you some money, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a security. Let's say it's a gold watch. Now, let's say that you go back in 6 months' time, you've got the interest, you've got the amount that you borrowed, and you say, right, I want to redeem the security, I want to buy the watch back. Okay, question. If they haven't got the watch, do you have to give him the money?
It depends. If they're a pawnbroker, no. If they're a bank, yes. I'm being facetious.
Well, according to the banker, right? But the point is, it's the same difference, right? It's a security. So when we are paying off a loan, credit card or whatever, we need to get the security back, right?
Yeah, well.
Right. So if they haven't got the security, what am I redeeming? What am I buying back? Redeem means to buy back. So what am I buying back? They send out redemption figures, right?
You're not getting anything back.
Right. So what? How can I redeem something they haven't got? And is there an obligation to redeem something like they haven't got? Because how can I redeem it?
And there is the most important question, of course. How can I redeem something you haven't got?
Absolutely. And if they haven't got it, is there an obligation to hand them the money? Because it's the same idea as the pawnbroker. If he's got rid of my gold watch, what am I giving him the money for? Because he's going to owe me a new gold watch. So therefore, why am I giving him the money? Either he has to go out and buy a new gold watch and then we then buy it back, or I don't give him the money.
It's just straightforward theft, surely that is.
Well, it's magic, isn't it? I mean, to actually get people to hand over, and it's because people don't understand, as you say, that necessarily the value in it, but also the implications of not redeeming those securities. And also what that inadvertently or indirectly gives the bank, effectively it gives the bank the ability to potentially offset that document against tax or collect in some other way. So the bank gets paid a couple of times. Now, if you go up to someone in the street and say, hey, you know what, when you pay your next loan off to the bank, would you be happy if the bank got a bonus from government of the same amount? Right? Now, I don't know whether most people would be happy with that. I don't know. But I would have thought a lot of people wouldn't be happy with it, because bankers get a lot of money anyway, and of course they never risk a penny. But if they can offset bad debt against tax or their tax bill, what does the bank ever really risk?
Nothing.
All it ever does is makes money, in all senses of the word. Well, cash.
Yeah. Well, if you consider someone who's got they've got a mortgage. They fall behind. For whatever reason, they've lost a job, there's illness, or whatever it happens to be. The bank won't deal with them until they're 3 months behind.
Yeah,
and the reason they won't deal with them before they're 3 months behind is because at that 90-day point, quite often, most of the time, the banks will be able to call on an insurance that they've got on that loan to pay it off. So, but then they'll still come after the person who is... who they say is responsible for paying that loan off, for the money.
Yeah.
So how many times are they going to get paid? Because they've got the note to start with that is often sold off as a special instrument. If you default after 90 days, they're going to get the money again from the insurance policy. Then they're going to come after you for the money. And if you don't have the money, they're going to take your house and sell it. It's immoral.
Yes, and stunningly lucrative. Mm. And one of the reasons why we're all so bloody busy trying to pay it all off, when in fact it appears that it was ours in the first place. I was pretty interested by your comments on insurance, Si, and how central that is to making the whole global thing work. For people who haven't heard about it before, would you like to say how insurance originated?
Well, I mean, you know, let's put it this way. Ultimately, you had ventures way back when, you know, someone's going to go off and potentially go off on some commercial venture. And, of course, they want to make sure that, let's say, for example, a ship owner, let's say there's three parties. Someone has an idea, right? Then you've got the financier. So he goes to see the financier to say, hey, got an idea. Do you want in on this deal? And they say, yeah, great. Let's go see a ship owner. So they go see the ship owner and they say, right, we've got this great idea. You're going to be sailing over to the West Indies to pick up a cargo of XYZ, right? Well, you know, ultimately, if the ship owner managed to get out there, right, unscathed, without pirates taking control of his vessel, without the seas, you know, taking his soul, as it were, and he managed to get out there and get his way back, right, then great. But if, you know, by some catastrophe, the vessel sinks, then if he manages to get back, let's say, you know, I don't know, swims right back, right, far-fetched, but let's pretend that he swims back, he's then going to be lumped with some kind of bill to pay the money back. So, of course, you know, you then have this thing called, you know, insurance that kind of comes into play, as it were, because, of course, he wants to make sure that if he manages to get back alive through all the you know, the potential hazards that he's got to overcome, that he's not going to be then held liable for it, all right? Now, obviously, you know, insurance is ultimately a gamble. So, you know, let's look at the scenario, right? I'm going to explain the same scenario, but I'm going to explain it in two different ways, right? So, I go down to the local insurance broker and I say, hey, you know, I want to insure my wife for £100,000 for the next 10 years. How much is it going to cost me? All right? And they might say, well, that's £1,000. And I say, oh, okay, right, that's fair enough. Okay, I'll pay the £1,000 and I'm now insuring my wife for £100,000 if she passes away in the next 10 years, right? That's a typical scenario, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's look at the same scenario, but in a different way. I go down to the betting office and I say, right, I've got £1,000 to put down. What odds are you going to give me if my wife dies? I reckon she's at it, right? So I reckon she's going to croak it in the next 10 years. What odds are you going to give me? And they kind of check her out and say, well, okay, look, we'll give you 100-1.
Yeah.
Now, what's the difference?
Betting tax.
I was
just going to put a bet on the other day for £1, an eight football game accumulator, and I went to pay the tax up front, and they said, what are you talking about? I mean, this is how long it's been since I put a bet on, you know, even a little bet on the horses or whatever. And they said, no, there's no betting tax anymore. So there's no betting tax anymore, right? So the point is...
Wow, they really want people to bet, don't they?
There is no difference. It's a gamble.
Yeah.
The whole thing's a gamble. Now, you know, any potential interest or any potential debt where anyone's got an interest that can be insured, right? So, for example, that, you know, you take a loan out, well, the chances that you are not going to pay that back can now be insured because I've got an interest in you paying me back, so I can therefore insure that interest. But now it potentially becomes into my benefit. You know, what if it's in my benefit and to my benefit that you fail, right?
Yeah.
If I've insured this, what if I've set this kind of thing up, whether it's from hedging and I've been...
Oh. I think we might have just lost them, guys. I think. Yep. I think we might just have to try and call them back again. Yeah, it's okay. I guess you can hear me out there. We just dropped the Skype call there. It's my Skype's now trying to reach his again. We'll see whether it works. If it doesn't, we'll probably put on a tune whilst it does. The thing about the insurance is people betting on each other's lives just seems to be quite remarkable. But Simon also points out that really without people taking out that kind of insurance on ships, then the whole global thing wouldn't work. The insurance is much more central to it. I mean, I haven't had a lot of time for it, really, insurance myself, because it's never actually worked for me. I'm going to... just put on a quick tune whilst we sort out what's actually happened to the guests. It's fun-loving criminals for you. Yeah, a bit of that. Why not? Back with you shortly, hopefully. George Thorogood and the Destroyers and Bad to the Bone. Well, we appear to have... that wasn't supposed to happen. Oh, a bit of unexpected stuff going on. Never mind. Looks like we're still on the stream, so that's fine. Yes, looks like we've lost the guests for the moment. We'll keep an eye out for them. Hopefully they'll get back to me to complete the conversation, because they do actually have some solutions to offer to the basic situation we find ourselves in. They're, at the moment, they, as Simon said, the website's only been up and running for barely a couple of months, really. And at the moment, the questions they're addressing in their little videos are, do banks actually loan money when making you a loan? What is cash? Why should I make a will? What is a credit card score and why does it matter? And feedback on mortgages problems, which is something that I really want to talk to Simon about, is the mortgages, because I know it's an item of special interest of his. It's been a big challenge to him over the last 3 years, if he comes back. And what they've done there is put together a set of little 10-minute videos that deal simply with the subject in hand, but in detail. And then they provide a load of help sheets for you to refer to in whatever plan it is that you might choose, or whatever gameplay it is that you might choose to take on as a result of the new information. But before Simon tied up with Mark, you'll have heard him mention the DVD set that he made, and I remember talking with him during the process of this, because he had it in mind, I think, to make half a dozen DVDs that basically tried to cover, you know, the kind of stuff we talk about, money, insurance, tax, the person, legislation, corporations, loans, credit cards, all of this stuff, because it's not really difficult, it's not really easy to talk about any one bit of it without referring to all the rest, so it's actually a pretty big story. And as his project developed, he ended up turning out, I don't know what it is in the end, I think it's 13 or 14 DVD set, which I'd had my beady little eye on for quite some time, and it's in three parts. The first part is called Welcome to the Rabbit Hole, and me and Synchro have like completely and totally enjoyed it. Simon's a great storyteller and a great presenter, and once he gets into the swing of things, it's really engrossing stuff. And the thing is, with his kind of professional background, the kind of overview he's got of the whole situation is really quite impressive. So he manages to put it into an order so that it's good revision for those of us who already know a fair bit of this stuff. And the thing is that there's a few little-known dots in there, I'm sure, that are connected for almost everybody who choose to listen to it. But the thing that's been striking me as I've been going through it is how good it would be to show some of this to what we might, for want of a better word, call the completely uninitiated. I've been having, as I'm sure we all do actually, I'm sure we're all used to these conversations where after 5 years of talking to people and listening to people being interviewed and listening to lawyers and law professors and policemen and Internal Revenue Service operators and customs and excise operators and all these other people, I'm sure you're all familiar with the thing where you try to bring some of this up and you're just treated like an idiot. Now, I'm more and more willing to step up to the plate and have a go at it. Like Simon, I tend to go for the money first. But I feel that we've all only got so much expertise, and I would, I intend locally, if it's at all possible, to get out there and do a couple of public screenings of a couple of the DVDs from Welcome to the Rabbit Hole, because the one that's about the money mostly, and the cash, and what is it, and what happens when we're apparently lent money and all the rest of it, is absolutely brilliant, and it would be, I think, so much better to be able to put forward together something that's been coherent and worked out before the public, and then answer questions on it, for example. I think I'd like to show people the insurance one as well. And the last DVD in the set does, in fact, deal with the legal definitions of persons and what legislation is and what corporations are. So one way or the other, there's... the way I figure it is, there's a really great introduction there for other people once the DVD set is available. His next one, I think the next one's called The Truth About Mortgages, Loans and Credit Cards, which will obviously fill in a bit more of the technical detail that he's already introduced people to in the first set. And then the last one I like, it's all packaged in black and it's called How to Hold Corporations to Account for Their Actions. And that, I think, is the real beating pulse of Simon Spaniard's work. It's what he spent his time really doing over all of these years. And I think it's great to hear that he's finally getting a vehicle together where he can work with somebody else to put it out without, you know, perhaps so much strain and and expense to himself. Now, obviously, it costs money to get the DVDs. I think he retails them at £40 a set, which means it's £120 for the whole lot, which sounds like a lot of gaming tokens. But when I think how much time and effort it's actually taken me to trawl together all the information that I've got whirring around in my little head, and all this stuff that I had to watch that I didn't really need to see in order to distill the stuff that I've got, I figure that that's really, really good value. It's a place where I know I can go, get a bit of entertainment. And like I say, it's hard copy, so I can hopefully use it to start showing to other people. I mean, I think it's probably true everywhere now that 5 years ago, very, very few people seemed to be interested in talking about any of this stuff at all. Nowadays, when I go about the place, whatever it is, you know, out to meditation meetings or to the pub or down the cafe, it's actually pretty frequent now to hear people talking about banks, particularly talking about mortgages and things like that. And my feeling is that people are perhaps more ready to be receiving this sort of information, so long as it's put across in a way that doesn't instantly turn them off. One of the amazing scams with the finance and everything is that it's all been made to look so utterly complicated. What Simon, with the help of Mark, manages to do is take this really complicated stuff, strip all the nonsense off the top, and give you the bare bones. And the bare bones of the financial system are actually pretty simple, if utterly horrifying. And I think, you know, to speak for Simon in his absence, because they don't appear to be coming back, I know that one of the things he says is that half of the government is missing. You know, the government he defines as both mind control and the controlling mind. It's the, if you like, the entity which is telling everybody else what to do, and that's what kind of filters down at the bottom level is a whole load of rules. But the bit of government that is missing is the people who ideally should be holding the men and women operating in the banks and these other public corporations to account, making sure that they are actually doing what they're paid to do, making sure that they're doing what the policy statements of their companies, their corporations, say they should be doing what their job descriptions describe as their job. But as we're all aware, and as Simon points out, we come across time and time again public servants who appear, rather than to be performing their office as such, are actually giving their version of it. And quite often this puts them outside their office, and so, you know, actually open to our questions. And his basic point is that if we do choose to hold these people to account, then it makes it a lot harder for them to move against us, to be taking the money off us and everything. The basic argument with the bank is, if you've given them the money in the first place and you're paying them money back to redeem that and they won't give it you back, why should you redeem it? It's a very good question. And in fact, it really does appear, and Simon makes perfectly clear in his DVDs, that there's a similar level of honesty in practically everything else that's going on. The banks are really just the tip of the iceberg. So fundamentally speaking, if we were to stand up and start addressing the men and women that we find approaching us with plastic labels around their necks and all of that kind of stuff, then fundamentally a lot of the abuse that we see around us would stop. It looks like I've got Mark coming back on again, so just give me a moment whilst I press this green button here. Hello there, Mark.
Hey, come back.
Excellent, well done, welcome back. A little bit of a technical hitch there.
Yeah, we don't know what it was, but there you go.
It's gone away now. Well, I did a bit of chatting in between, but hopefully now that you're back, we can continue. Both relaxed, both all right, looking pretty chill.
Oh, yeah.
So
ready to go to bed, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. We've probably got about 10, 15 minutes or so to go before I play a couple of tunes to play out. So why don't we look at just exactly how it is we can approach all of these things? And I think perhaps we could approach it with your ideas on government, Simon, what you think is missing from government, why it is that it's not working at all in our favour.
Honestly, it's missing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we need to police them.
Yeah. I'm just going to turn the camera off, so because I'm actually on the mobile here.
Oh, okay.
I've got to tell us when we're live, because there's someone put a note up about their daughter, Kenzie, 12.
Oh, right. Yes, you are live, actually. I was cruel there. I called you straight back in live.
We are live?
We are live, yeah, I think so.
All right, okay. Well,
jolly good.
You may have heard that there. So, happy birthday, Kenzie, from Si and Mark.
Yes, indeed.
All right, you can tell all your friends at school you've been mentioned on the radio.
Yeah, Dr. Rock says happy birthday, Kenzie, too.
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, you're looking good here.
We seem to have lost sound there.
Have you? Can you not hear me?
That was louder with the
I'll tell you what, folks, whilst this goes on, we'll just fish another tune out of the what we got here.
Here we go, got it.
Oh, okay, we're back. Excellent. Live radio, folks, it shows it's live. So... We appear to have a whole lot of public servants who don't seem to realise that they're public servants. They seem to think that we're the servants, Simon. Is there anything we can do about this?
Right, well, there was I was talking to Mark about this earlier, and I think we mentioned it when we had the pre-chat prior to the show. And there was an article in the press today, Daily Mail, and it mentioned that I think roughly two-thirds of employees don't think that they can actually do their jobs.
Two thirds now.
I don't know if it was limited to public servants or if it just included some public servants, but you know, look, ultimately if someone's a member of staff, you know, well, anyone who's going out to get a job, let's put it that way, if you don't feel that you can do your job, I mean, ultimately, well, what is it that you feel you need to learn in order to do your job? Is it a problem? Is it a situation whereupon we've got people waiting to be taught, or is it a situation where we've got people that desperately want to do a better job but don't know where to start? I mean, I don't know, right? I've got a funny feeling that the majority of it is that most of them expect to be led to water and then shown how to drink. In fact, not even shown how to drink, to have the water, you know, maybe put into them in some kind of intravenous drip or something like that. So. The point is, there was a film called Fair Game, which starred Sean Penn. It's a clip, and I've made mention of it on one of the videos on the White Rabbit, actually. And, you know, ultimately, this thing that we call government, you know, could it work? Let's put it this way. Could the system work as it is at the moment? Well, I think the answer is yes. I think it could work, right? Ignoring taking money out of it and the way that that works, in terms of actual system, could it work as it is at the moment? And I think the answer is yes. Why doesn't it work? I think the answer is really simple. The majority of people are not doing their jobs. And I don't mean when they go out to work. I mean they're not doing their job in terms of as a part or facet of government. For example, right, if there are issues, if someone notices an issue with a member of staff at the council, or in a company, or an MP, or the police, or the NHS, or whatever it may well be, if you just allow that issue to remain and you do nothing to try to change it, prevent it, stop it, correct it, whatever, then you are partly to blame for everything that is wrong with what we consider government and the system and the way that it's all running at the moment to be.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know, because ultimately... You know, members of, you know, public servants, for example, who's going to watch public servants? What, other public servants? Well, yes and no. Moreover, it's more kind of like a big club and they kind of scratch each other's backs. The problem is the people that watch the public servants are supposed to be us, right? And you're not going to be told, because why would public servants want you to come and watch over them? They don't. So, you know, I think we were talking earlier that, you know,
you know, you park somewhere incorrectly, you get a ticket straight away. There's no warning. There's no, well, let's put it through a complaints process. You know, put that ticket through my complaints process and I'll consider whether I've done anything wrong, right? Mm-hmm. It's a case of, no, you've got to pay this or else. Now, if we apply the same line of thinking, the same standard to public servants and people that are working in their companies, do public servants, do people who work for companies that punish customers or punish members of the public for the first mistake, slightest mistake, and sometimes even when it's in a grey area, a dubious possible mistake but maybe not a mistake, people get punished for it. So by the same token, do those very same members of staff and public servants want us to apply the same standard, the same rule of thumb to them? Because if that's the case, then, you know, the number of public servants that actually cover the entire population or cater for the entire population of this country is not many. And that means that there's lots of us and there's not many of them, right? And, you know, what if, and this is something that we, you know, I've discussed with Mark, we're going to have this on the You and Your Cash, you know, website, actually, maybe a little solution to help people do this. But what if every time you had an interaction with a member of staff, you gave them feedback, right? You gave them feedback. So think about it. You know, if everything is sound, just to get a little bit esoteric there, but if everything is sound, if the universe was created from sound or by sound, right? And we think about when we're listening to music and you get feedback. I mean, obviously, we're kind of electricity as well. So you get feedback. But when do we ever give feedback to the sound that's coming out away, right? We never do, right? So what if we were to give feedback? And what if with every single interaction we were to give feedback, and fair's fair, if it's just what you expect, you don't necessarily give any feedback. If it's better than expected, you send a well done letter to the member of staff and you explain what they did well, and you send a copy to human resources, right? Because fair's fair, credit where credit is due. If someone goes the extra mile, right, to make you happy and look after you, they deserve a pat on the back, and we shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, and of course the advantage of sending it to HR is that the right people then get promoted, and hopefully their right attitude will then go down the line to the people under them.
Absolutely. But by the flip side of the coin, if you have an interaction where the member of staff hasn't performed properly, right, according to your standards, you send the member of staff a letter pointing out where they went wrong. And you say, you know, do better next time, must do better, right? D minus or whatever. Yeah. And you send the copy to human resources. Now, I'm going to be producing some letters like this, which we're going to have on the site, right? Now, how many times, you know, what if we were to do that? That's just a small thing, okay? But the point is, if a member of staff does something which is technically, which could be a mistake, but it's technically, you know, if that was going on frequently, it could be a sackable offence. Why don't we go for the jugular? Would the members of staff that are issuing these penalties, notices, doing the this, doing the that, not investigating what they're doing, bearing in mind two-thirds of staff don't say they don't know their job, it's amazing how many staff refuse to investigate when you raise a question. So what is it that's stopping them from doing this? But I wonder how many members of staff would be happy if every time they goofed up, we went for their jobs to get them sacked.
Yeah.
Would they appreciate that? And would they continue to apply that rule of thumb against members of the public?
Yeah. Well, I'm going through something like that with HSBC Bank at the moment. One of their staff shared my personal details by putting a whole load of names in the address bar, the two bar, and sending out my personal information to all of those people. Now, the problem is that I wrote to his immediate superior and said, are you aware he's done this? Are you aware he's broken this law, that law, and the other law? I expect you to take this matter seriously and do something about it. All they did was refer it to their boss, and their boss did write back to me and tried to make light of it. He spoke about everything else except that, apart from one line at the beginning, which said, I must apologise on behalf of my staff. I was quite happy with that because he actually admitted the thing had happened.
Yeah.
But now trying to get who is the head of HR out of HSBC has been one of the most awkward investigative things I've ever been on. They don't want to tell me who it is. But the thing is, what they don't understand is that it's actually a point of European data protection law that they are supposed to say, freely say, who their data controller is.
Yeah. How else are you going to hold them accountable?
Exactly. So, you know, I don't want to go into too much about what I'm going to do going forward, but they are making a whole heap of problems for themselves. And I think they don't care because they've had the whole arena to themselves. They've been in the law. They've decided what happens in every situation. And it's something that I think we had a conversation the other day. Part of the response I got from HSBC was that it was their internal procedures that this is how it was happened. But Simon said that might be their internal procedures, but it's not mine. I don't work for HSBC. I don't have to follow their procedures.
No.
And that's something that they are not willing to take on board, understand or realise the amount of mess it's going to get them into.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because because they haven't been watched for so long, they seem to have strayed an awfully long way from the official path, and so I would have thought thoroughly exposed a lot of them.
Well, look, let's put it this way, right? Government was born of man, right?
Yeah.
It's our child, right?
Yeah.
Can't disagree with that.
And we've allowed the children, or the child, to do whatever it wants without supervision.
Right, yeah.
Now, if people actually did that with their kids, the kids would be taken away and someone else would supervise them.
Mm.
Right. But there's no one else to take the child away, government. Right. There's no one there to take that away. We've left the child the children that are running that service. We've left them to their own devices. We have not come back to supervise them or chastise them or teach them right from wrong. And so, yeah, it's going to be a culture shock for them because, of course, they've made hay while we've been away. Right. That rhymes. So, of course, it is a... I'm a poet, don't you know it?
I do.
And so it is going to be a culture shock for them when people start coming back and starting to hold them and wanting to hold them accountable and making moves to hold them accountable. And I can understand that it would be a culture shock for these people. Okay. Is it a situation where, well, you know, you can't just come back and start saying these things and demanding these standards because you've let it slide for so long? Well, yeah, we have allowed it to slide. And, you know, and that is the fault of the people. It's the fault of each and every one of us that became lethargic and that became complacent and trusted the child to tell us what to do.
Yeah.
The child telling the parent what to do. What is wrong with that picture?
How easy is it to find out what these people are supposed to be doing?
Well, you go onto their website and you pull off their policy. A lot of government websites now will have their policies. And plus, of course, they've got Acts of Parliament. You go through the Act of Parliament. And, you know, so the point is, it's a case of, you know, depending on your questions, the way that you ask certain questions, and I'm not going to attempt to give numerous examples right now, but the way I look at it is this, you know, the way that we spell words and words are spells, and the way that you compose your sentence or your sentences it increases the power of the spell. So it's the way that we're asking questions and the way that we're putting it across to members of staff. Depending on how you do that, it carries different weight. It carries different power. And, you know, and plus, of course, added to all of that, you've got to have your will to see that through. You've got to have the desire, the intention, the purpose and the willpower to see it through to the end. And unless we've got that, we're never going to turn that around. The child will always be telling the parent what to do. But it is our child. It is our combined child, our collective child. It's born of man.
Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, is if you're writing to a company's HR and the person that you are writing to them about has done something that's clearly wrong, then you can say it's clearly wrong and you don't believe it can be in accordance with that company's policy for that particular employee. Now, it's then up to the company to turn around and say it is or it's not. Now, if they've done something wrong or even illegal, for them to turn around and say it's part of their policy, well, they've condemned themselves. If they turn around and say it's not part of our policy, they've confirmed your case. So whichever way, you're on a winning line that needs to be followed up.
And you do put them in a difficult question, just a difficult position, just by asking questions, don't you? Because they're not used to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I mean, I've played this kind of hand a number of times, but I'm certainly playing it more frequently now. And that is that, you know, if members of staff do something wrong, if they don't do what I demand in order to correct it and make me satisfied, I immediately ask them to put me through to HR.
Why do you want that?
Exactly, and that is the reaction. And the reaction and the reason I give is I say, well, you know, look, at the end of the day, I think you've done something wrong. You're not making me happy. You're not complying with the statements, the big bold statements on your website, which is the standard, the banner that you have agreed and signed up for, and pick up a paycheck to uphold. So therefore, I've got a bit of a grievance with you, and I don't think that you're the right, you know, kind of person to be working for that company. So if you want to stick me through to HR, I just want to have a word with someone that can actually affect your career. Thanks very much.
That's great, really, because we hear a lot of advice, don't we, suggesting, oh, you need to get the name of the CEO and all that sort of stuff, whereas I much prefer the idea of actually dealing with the individual that's in front of you or on the end of the phone.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, I like it for shock value, to be honest. You know, I love to hear the change in their voice when you suddenly ask to be put through to HR.
Yeah.
And it's a situation where, you know, you can always say, well, look, I tell you what, you can either punch me through to HR and I'll explain to them why I think you shouldn't be working here, or we can start again and you can have another go. What would you prefer to do?
Excellent.
Have another go and, you know, and do things properly, or shall I, you know, show you?
Report me. I don't like working here anymore.
Or shall I seal your fate, as it were?
Then do you find that they normally do know how to do things properly? They're just choosing not to, or they don't actually know?
Yeah.
No, I think it's a mixed bag of sweets, to be honest. I think, you know, it's like anything. I've managed, you know, I used to manage 70 staff. Okay. And I know that, you know, when new members of staff join, if they're sat with someone that doesn't do the job properly and cuts corners, then guess what? The new member of staff is not going to do it properly and he's going to cut corners.
Yes.
Right? The second facet you've got into that is obviously management, supervision and control. If the manager is not skilled at managing and is not big and bold enough or attentive to detail to pull up their staff, well, then members of staff are going to get away, you know, with slackness and bending the rules and doing this, that and the other. You know, we are each responsible for, in a way, policing each other and keeping each other in check. And that goes for many facets of life, you know, in terms of what's right and wrong out on the streets, in terms of our balance when we're making decisions, in terms of whether we're being harsh with people, chastising little ones, or whatever the case may be. You know, we're each responsible for keeping each other in check and ourselves in check. But we don't do it. We think that we can appoint someone to do a job over there, and that's it. The mere fact that we've appointed them and we've written down some policy, that is it. That's what, we don't need to actually manage them and check what's going on. That's it. The piece of paper will manage the process. Well, you know, shock horror for those in government and those in big companies, pieces of paper cannot possibly manage people.
No. And we can see how well that, you don't have to look too hard to see how well that approach is serving us.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's just, you know, I mean, one of the classic examples, you know, the FSA, right? The FSA, the members of staff that worked there failed. They failed. So Osborne rebrands the FSA into the, you know, the PRA and the FCA, splits them off into two bodies, writes a new policy. We've got a new policy. We've got a new piece of paper. And he employs the exact same losers. And I'm sorry, I appreciate you're not all losers, but the management team obviously clearly were losers, incapable of managing, or something else was going on. But whatever it was, they weren't regulating when they should have been. They weren't watching when they should have been, right? They weren't in control when they're supposed to be. And here we are, we've got, you know, we've got the losing team running it again. And so what actually, I don't understand why Cameron, Osborne or anyone else would think that if I go and take, back to my football example, if I go and take all my, and no disrespect to the lads, but if we took all the players at Chalkwell United, you know, at Chalkwell United, and we then said, right, what we're going to do, right, we're second from bottom in the entire Football Association League, we're going to change the name of the club.
Oh, that will work.
Now, where do you think we're going to finish next season, right? Are we suddenly going to win the Premiership? No, because we've got the same personnel, right? We might do a little bit better if we start taking it seriously, but you're not going to make groundbreaking changes overnight just because you changed the name of the team.
And this is, again, what we see right across the board, isn't it? Because the all of the bankers who were in charge of banks during the 2008 collapse have now actually got themselves jobs in financial probity with the government. which
what, advisors?
Yeah, yeah, all of them. As I've been watching them in private eye, they gave us a big list recently of where all these various executives have ended up. And they've all been rewarded for what we might deem to be failure. So the question we have to ask ourselves is whether the people making the promotions actually feel that the banking crash was a failure.
Well, you see, they were actually very pleased because they didn't lose as much as they might have. So they considered that a victory.
Wait, you mean they didn't steal as much? Oh, sorry.
Ooh, yeah. No, you can't say you can't say the truth like that.
The thing is, I mean, look, ultimately, if you allow it to happen and to continue, then you're allowing it to happen and to continue. And until people generally start taking responsibility, if they want to protect and uphold this system that we have, then each member of the public, everyone has to take responsibility and make an effort to make it work. And by making it work, what I mean is not just going along with what your local council official tells you to do, but I mean making it work and applying standards, educating themselves, understanding what the requirements are, what the duties of these people are, and understanding how to hold these people accountable. And then, when necessary, holding them accountable. If you turn a blind eye, then all hell is going to break loose. And I would argue that hell has broken loose, and it's a free-for-all. And, you know, and people feel, you know, kind of helpless and this, that and the other. But, you know, look, just start somewhere. It doesn't matter. Start small if you have to, but start somewhere. The point is you have to make a first step and you have to start. If you're not going to start, well, then, you know, we're just talking nonsense. It's just a misnomer. You've got to start, right? And that's it.
That's the thing, isn't it? Is that with the knowledge without taking action is nothing. We have to do something ourselves at this point.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter how small. I mean, we were talking about that film, weren't we? The Experimenter.
Yeah.
And I mentioned, for people out there that are listening and haven't watched it, you know, this is where the this kind of explains the Nazi death camps and this, that, and the other. In as much as, you know, I was only following orders, or I was following orders. And basically what you had is you had a setup in a university, I think it was in the States, you had this setup. So you had a couple of people walk in, they're greeted, and both the people are apparently volunteers, and they're both paid for their time. And they're both told that no matter what happens from this point onwards, the money is yours, doesn't matter, you can leave whenever you want, but we'd like to do an experiment. Now, one of the two people that have walked in is on the team of the university, right? And they're going to go and sit in a booth where apparently they're going to be administered electric shocks. And the other volunteer, who is actually the genuine member of the public, unsuspecting, is now being told by someone wearing a white coat. So position of authority is just like wearing a luminous jacket nowadays. You know, they must know what they're doing. They've got a luminous jacket on. So this guy wearing a white suit is saying, right, I want you to administer another shock. And it gets to a point where the guy who's basically acting and not being shocked is screaming out for mercy and this, that and the other. But because the person administering the shocks is basically saying, well, hold on, you know, maybe raising a few questions, but because they're being told to continue, they just continue. And in the film, as I watched about half the film, and only one guy had actually turned round and walked out. Now, I think, Doc, you were saying that that was actually then enhanced, wasn't it? That test, that experiment was then enhanced, wasn't it?
Yes, it was modified recently. They chose to extend the experiment and so that the experimental subject who was administering the electric shocks was also part of the setup, and they let people watch that individual kind of administer the shocks. And for part of the experiment, they decided to have somebody who was extremely reluctant to issue the shocks and eventually got up and walked out. And they found out that with that modification, only 1 out of 10 people was actually willing to give the shocks. So it seems that the example we're given, the role model or whatever, is absolutely vital to how the masses behave.
But in another way of looking at it, is that if people stand up, others will follow.
Mm. Yes, I think that's exactly right. And it's because we haven't. It's because we haven't that we've ended up all of us accidentally standing in the shadow as we are.
Mm. Yeah. Or maybe there's, you know, maybe it's just not reached a point where it's, you know, I mean, I know it's fairly obvious in some in some corners of the internet and, you know, on some YouTube channels and this, that and the other. And there are certain, you know, parties in certain scenes that are very big in standing up to various things. And there are lots of people that stand up in various different ways. But perhaps, you know, it's just a case whereby people have to be shown. I don't know. But all I do know is that the longer that people allow, you know, the child, public servants, government, to do what it wants unchecked, the longer it's going to go and do what it wants unchecked.
Yeah.
It's obvious. It's just obvious.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, thankfully, I don't have kids. You know, I was gonna make a video, so I think I'll say it now. You know, look, you know, I don't have kids, right? So let's put it this way. What's to stop me just seeing out my next 40 years, if I'm lucky, and just saying, well, to hell with it. Why should I bother?
Yeah.
But I am bothering, right? And so is Mark. Mm. Although you got kids?
Yeah.
I'm a granddad, he's a granddad. So the point is, you know, part of me in trying to get a reaction, a positive reaction, not a negative reaction, but in trying to get a positive reaction and getting people to do something, you know, I kind of almost felt like saying, well, why should I bother? It's you people out there that have got the kids. You brought them into this world. I made the conscious decision not to do that because I thought that this world wasn't worthy to have my descendants brought into it. I wasn't going to subject them to it. So I made the conscious decision not to do that. Now, why should I bother sticking my very, shall we say, chiseled backside on the line? Why should I do that, right? Because other people can't be bothered to ensure that their offspring are not going to be enslaved in this banking system, living in a world which is just being overrun by, you know, by people doing whatever they want in the name of public service.
Do you think that one of the things that makes people hold back a bit is they feel that it's all so huge and massive that one person can't make a difference? And
maybe, but isn't there another way of looking at that? I mean, for example, you know, what if one guy could change the world, right? I mean, has anyone tried?
Well, Adolf did quite a good job. There must be a lot.
Oh, well, you know, look, I mean, yeah, maybe, well, he did. He succeeded to a large extent in what he was pursuing, and he got a lot of people following him, right? And that could be said of a lot of tyrants or dictators and this, that, and the other. But then again, that's usually done under the threat of everyone's too scared to say no. But the point
eventually,
is...
People follow because they see a way out from the mess that they understand they're in.
Yeah, they just don't foresee that it could be a greater mess they're walking into. Mm. And the point is, well, let's put it this way. I think one of the flaws that we fall for, one of the tricks we fall for, is that we go for all the big, bold statements, right? I mean, God, we see this in the press all the time. It just astonishes me how many people just constantly fall for this trick. Let me ask a question. Based on government policy as it stands at the moment, can anyone tell me or describe to me what's life going to be like in, say, 30 years' time? For me, for example.
Well, I don't know. According to your previous statement, you could be dead.
Or, okay, like, it's a like typical, you know, single mum, one kiddie. What's life going to be like for her? The point I'm trying to make is that government, as it is at the moment, politicians as they are at the moment, they never, ever, ever tell you what it is we're working towards.
That's because their agenda is different.
Yeah.
Their agenda that they are working towards is their pension. They've only got to be in office for a few short years in order to get it.
No, absolutely. But this is kind of my point. Why are people following and voting for something which is effectively heading in a direction that no one knows? What direction is it headed in? Because no one knows. No one's actually said, well, this is what we're aiming for. These are our standards. This is our ethos. And this is what we're working towards, right? We're not necessarily going to hit it tomorrow, but that's our ideal and that's what we want to work towards. That doesn't exist in politics.
Well, I think not only do they not tell you where it is we're going to be going, but what they do tell you in their manifestos turns out to be bunkum anyway.
No, absolutely. And this is another question, another thing. If Cameron is prepared to breach his pledges and break his pledges, why should we keep our pledges? Malt, gauge, solemn, you know, is a pledge. Pledge is a solemn promise. So if he's going to break his pledges, why should, and he's got to lead by example, right? He's the top boy, the prime preacher.
The prime
preacher is not going to keep to his promises, and as a public servant in public office, one of the seven principles of holding public office is that you lead by example. So following his example, should we keep our promises?
Yeah, we should, because we're better than that.
Maybe.
It's difficult, isn't it, that one? Because, yeah, one of the reasons why we're in such a mess is because people ain't keeping their promises.
Yeah, and also because we allow it, we turn another, you know, we just turn around and we turn a, you know, and turn the other cheek or whatever when he doesn't keep his promises, and people vote him back in.
Yeah, I think there's a difference, though, isn't there, in government? Well, government expects you to keep promises you didn't make. They make it on your behalf.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if you make a promise, you're honour-bound, if you believe in honour, to keep it.
Yeah.
But when government makes a promise or anyone makes a promise on your behalf, where's the contract?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it seems to me that they're constantly acting in dishonour, if only by lying by omission or lying outright to us, quite obviously, but it doesn't seem to stop people voting for them, which is a of real course. Mystery.
Well, that's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a weakness on the part of the people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, ultimately, you know, I don't think I've ever, well, don't get me wrong, I used to vote at one point in time, and of course, you know, mum and dad used to vote for a particular party, and you kind of followed suit because that's, I guess, what most people do, right?
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, I was never, ever afraid of phoning up local public servants, and if I felt they weren't, you know, pulling their weight, I'd give them a piece of my mind. I knew it wouldn't necessarily get anything done or anything changed, but it made me feel better.
Yeah.
You know, it just at least made me feel right. Why, you at least know where I'm coming from and what I think of what you guys have achieved, you know. And I just think if everyone did it, if everyone just followed suit, what could things become? Who knows?
We need to find out.
There's not an easy answer. There maybe is an easy answer, but I think it's going to take a lot more people to start finding their own power and their own strength and their own standards before anything's going to change. And I guess that was, you know, that's another one of the reasons that we wanted to try and approach the mainstream and get into the mainstream and try to get some of these concepts and even, you know, just inspire people or encourage people just to even ask questions, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, just think differently. Inspire people to think differently. Before we kind of wrap up, I don't think any radio conversation between you and I, Simon, would be complete without wherever it is we've got to in your mortgage battle with Santander.
Right, okay. Well, it's at a bit of a sensitive stage at the moment. Don't get me wrong, I've been offered something that I don't think anyone else has been offered in the country. But I won't say too much about it. Temporarily, that's been kind of accepted, but the kind of ongoing battle goes on, as it were. Let's just put it this way. The process that I've gone through over the last, say, 14 months, what I've experienced, has actually, and this is while it's been with solicitors, right? But that's kind of taught me one or two things, which kind of culminated in the mortgage seminar being launched in November last year.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I say, I don't want to say too much, and I can't say too much because it's quite a sensitive situation with regards to Red Satan. But I am confident in saying that I think I've achieved something that I don't think, certainly to my knowledge, I don't think other companies have been offered. Let's put it that way. And I've learnt, I would say, about one or two of their chinks has been confirmed. Let's put it that way. I've been able to confirm some chinks.
You're kind of, I mean, this must
have been a case of watch this space, isn't it?
This must have been going on for 5 years, and it took you 3 years to get your terms and conditions out of them and stuff like that. Do you think we will see in our lifetime it's a bastion of unscrupulousness, the mortgage. Do you think we'll actually see it crack?
I think so, yeah. Yes. And something I predicted a good few years back, which was that, look, you know, let's say, just hypothetically speaking, let's say that where barristers and solicitors were perhaps on the band of the banks and riding that surf, right, in terms of attacking borrowers, customers, and this, that, and the other, railroading them, and so on and so forth. There would come, as people start to, you know, query and question, battle against it, and as maybe, you know, maybe even laymen, maybe even some barristers, and I know, you know, I've met or spoken to a barrister who his pet hobby is researching mortgages, actually, and trying to dissect the things. And, you know, it, funnily enough, as a side tangent, he's actually had a success in court in actually proving mis-selling, right?
Whee.
So, yes, absolutely. So I kind of figured that at some point in time, if barristers and solicitors felt or got wind of the fact that, well, okay, look, maybe this is going to the tide is going to turn, right? There would be a situation, even if it was going to lead to the destruction or the complete collapse of the system as we know it, they would still want to get in that window and get their pound of flesh while they could, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And it's starting, because if you search on Google, there are a number of firms now who are attacking mortgage products actively. And of course, as I just mentioned, you know, I've now come across a barrister who has won, right? And has defeated, I don't know whether it was the mortgage lender or whether he issued the proceeding against the financial services compensation scheme. But in effect, he's taking them on, right? Now, he's given me a brief explanation as to, you know, what area he's looking at and how he kind of attacks this thing. And I've kind of, that's, you know, it's distinct from what I've been looking at. And it kind of emphasizes the point that every single stage of the mortgage process from start to finish, I think there are flaws. And I find it very hard pressed to actually find anything that is bona fide about the whole thing, which is why it's easier to say what's right about a mortgage than what's wrong. Because, you know, if you say what's wrong, I'd basically say, well, pretty much everything. You know, it's just a fudge. It's not true in the sense of what it's actually called.
All right, give me a quick example. What is right with a mortgage? That much? Oh, right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
There you go. So, that you know, that's what I think is actually right. I mean, you know, and it boils down to a simple truth with regards to an old death pledge, right? So let's look at the death pledge. You know, way back when, you don't pay your debt, I kill you.
Yeah.
Death pledge.
Yeah.
They used to hang debtors, right?
Mm.
Right. Nowadays, right, but now, okay, fast forward, obviously they don't do that now.
Don't they? Okay. Have you evidence to back that up?
They'll chuck you out on the streets, which is tantamount to attempted murder, in my opinion.
They kind of just grind you into the ground. They just kill your soul, basically, your willpower, to, you know, your will to live. But you know, look, the old-fashioned mortgage relied on the fact that the security that you were attempting to pay off passed into the hands of the bank. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, but who's going to put their home in the hands of the bank, pay it off for 25 years so they can then live in it? That defeats the object, right?
Yeah.
Right. So they had to fudge it. The product is fudged. It's not actually a real mortgage.
Because it's based on the note, not on the bricks and mortar.
Well, hold on, because herein lies a potential avenue of attack. What is the security? You see, the bank does hold a security, but it's not the security you think it is. What do they physically hold?
Well, they physically hold the mortgage deed, don't they, or the loan note?
Yeah, they hold the mortgage, and the mortgage is security, right, for the loan.
Yeah.
And they often word, you have to look at the wording, but sometimes they'll say that, you know, the mortgage is security for the loan, and the property described in the mortgage deed.
Mm.
described
yeah.
In the mortgage deed. Right, now, can you get a bricks and mortar home in the mortgage deed?
Mm.
Only if it's a very big piece of paper.
Or a very small bricks and mortar home.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one.
Right. So the point is, the mortgage product is a fudged product. And that's not me saying it. This is actually very well recognised law commentators who are making these statements. Right?
So it is weakening then.
It's recognised. Yeah. It's recognised that the mortgage product is a fudge.
Mm.
It's a fudged product. It's not really truly what it says on the tin, right? Now, when you then start looking at the mechanism of how these things are sold, how they're set up, how the conveyance takes place, what the conveyancer is supposed to do, what interests he's supposed to protect, mm-hmm. and whose interests he's supposed to act in, when you start raising, looking very carefully at this, well, let's put it this way. I think you know, albeit the fact that the, you know, the seminar that we did in November actually used some different wording and perhaps made it a lot more technical or technically correct, when I achieved a 40 grand reduction on a 110 grand mortgage balance in a probate case, I used very roughly, in rough layman's terms, the technique that I'm now applying using what I think is the correct language, yeah, to actually achieve that reduction.
Excellent.
Successfully, right? Yeah. I was offered within 2 hours, £40,000 offered off of a 110 grand balance. That's a 35%-ish reduction.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's better than a punch in the face, right? Better than nothing. Now, the point is, you know, I think in that instance, we could have pushed it because it was a probate case. It's not as if the borrower was worried. So.
And also, if that was their first offer, they're still making, aren't they?
Well, yeah, you never accept your first offer, right?
No.
Never accept the first offer, potentially accept the third offer, right?
Yeah.
So the point is, do I think that product will collapse? Yes, I do. Unfortunately, though, will government maybe step in? It's all hypothetical. Will government maybe step in and try to protect the banks and this, that, and the other? I've got no doubt that they will protect these entities that are too big to fail based on, you know, I mean, they only exist because of confidence, faith, and belief, but they're too big to fail.
Yeah.
Anyway, they would have said nothing, that. No further comment on it.
They would have said that.
It's nothing to do with the fact that the government makes more money out of the banks than any other part of the finance.
Well, and I think we have to look at, you know, those key players in government. I mean, which families are they linked to? Who are their relatives? I mean, if you look at Cameron, for example, you know, as I understand it, he and his missus, I've seen news reports saying both of them are descendants of slave empires and slave businesses. And, you know, I think Haiti, the Haitian people, I don't know if I've said that correctly, but they wanted compensation for the slave trade, which decimated and affected, you know, their country and their population in, you know, times way back when. And Cameron turned around, I think it was, and said, yeah, no problem, the British taxpayer will pick up that bill. Why didn't Cameron pick up the bill? He's inherited the money.
Yeah.
Why has it not come out of his inheritance?
Yeah. As usual.
Now, as I say, different newspapers. One newspaper said it was his wife that had inherited the slave empire money, right? So blood money. And one newspaper was saying that it was, and I don't know, and different amounts have been printed and then changed and this, that, and the other. So, you know, you don't really know all the facts. Only they know the facts. But, you know, if they're both the descendants and they're living off the benefit of slavery, well, what does that say about those people?
Mm.
He's our leader, though, right? Do as he does.
Well, the thing is, in the long run, I think that the you know, one of the major challenges faced by the shadow is the undoubted and indubitable sort of supremacy of light.
Yeah.
You know, it's well, it's.
We can only try.
Yeah. Well, the effort needs to be put in, and I mean, it sounds like you're definitely doing it. Also, one of these days, we'll have you on the radio, and we will hear the end of the mortgage story. are you still charging them for? Do you still invoice and charge them for all of the work you do when you're following these things up?
No, because you have to. Well, let's put it this way: I haven't done that. In fact, funny enough, that you've reminded me. Actually, maybe I should be doing that. But it has. I've been so busy with other stuff; it hasn't even crossed my mind. I just haven't had a time to even think of doing that paperwork. So, you know, to a large extent, with what's kind of going on with Santander. It's a kind of slow process, and I've had to try and balance things because, of course, you know, I've got an ex that is quite worried about certain things, and I've had to kind of balance that with regard, you know, with my efforts to, you know, sock it to Santander. You know, so as I say, I can't go into it too deeply at the moment. I'm hoping to get myself into a position whereupon I can kind of reveal what happened and what has happened. But as I say, I think that I've achieved something that not. If there's anyone else that's achieved it, I think there's not going to be many. Certainly from what I've been reading with online forums, it's a surprise it hasn't actually gone to court, but it's never gone to court, let's put it that way. Mm. And I don't think they dare take it to court.
They don't want to, do they?
I don't think so.
That's what they're doing, isn't it? The first one that actually makes it into a court, they are in deep trouble if the individuals that do that know what they're doing.
Well, in my one, well, let's put it this way. In the Santander conditions, it states quite clearly they require the power of attorney in order to enforce their rights under the mortgage. And I've got two letters stating there is no power of attorney.
Yeah, yeah.
So they can't enforce their rights, right?
Indeed, yeah, indeed. But you have found the power of attorney, didn't you? Once you did get the terms and conditions, it didn't take you long to find it.
Oh, it didn't take long to find that at all.
No.
And, you know, all I would say to... If anyone wants to do some research, try to acquire lots of different terms and conditions. Because when you look at lots and lots of different terms and conditions, you start seeing things that, you know, your own set of terms and conditions is going to limit you, right? But the moment you start looking at lots and lots of different terms and conditions, you start seeing different things and how different banks describe different things. And it starts to give you a few clues.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So are you concentrating all on your website work now, or are you going to be out doing some more sort of forums and the rest of it? Have you got anything that you'd like people to know about they might want to come along to?
Well, it's funny you say that. God, we couldn't have planned that better, you know, ourselves if we'd asked you. But at the end of this month, we've got a seminar, joint seminar, White Rabbit, you and your cash. And if anyone wants details on that, they can actually email either help@youandyourcash.com or info@youandyourcash.com or whiterabbiteducation@gmail.com. And so, yeah, we're doing a Saturday the 30th. We've got a seminar. And in terms of the mortgage thing, you know, obviously there's a mortgage DVD that we've produced now. So that's available via White Rabbit, although it's going to be rejigged as well for the You and Your Cash audience at some point in time, and probably enhanced. You know, because when I'm allowed to flow, when I'm flowing at the White Rabbit things, you know, sometimes I come out with stuff and it has to be edited out.
Yeah.
Because I release too much kind of, you know, private stuff or stuff that I don't necessarily want out. And so it requires a lot of editing. Whereas I think with the You and Your Cash, it just gets me in a different mindset.
Yeah.
You know, it gets me in a different mindset. Yeah. And
the live events, when people go to our live events, they get a far more intimate understanding of the things you're talking about.
I just couldn't out
in the public.
I can't state enough how entertaining I find Simon's seminars. I have a tendency to kind of drop off after about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but I went to a couple of days with Simon and I was alert as a skinless eye for the whole thing. It was great. And of course people can sign up to your You and Your Cash website so that they get notified of new questions and new help sheets and all that kind of stuff as well, can't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, you can just literally put your email address on there and you'll automatically get notified with each new show. And the whole, you know, again, one of the, there's many, many facets to the You and Your Cash website. You know, one of the kind of goals was to almost create a kind of solutions repository.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, anyone who wants to be notified and then have access to some solutions and some discussion, and we're going to hopefully cover, you know, well, I think we're going to surprise some people with where we go with it.
Yeah, I'll bet you
some
are.
Some facets and some kind of areas. Yeah. I like self-empowerment and stuff like that, motivational stuff. And, you know, we want to help people to actually, well, let's put it this way. The same study in the Daily Mail, the one that said that 2/3 of workers didn't think they knew their jobs, there was at least, I think, 1/3 who were unhappy and hated their jobs. And half of workers felt that they were in dead-end jobs. So, you know, we want to try and encourage people.
How many of those were in the private sector, in the public sector?
I don't know. I've got no idea. But the thing is, you know, look, there's so many people that are out there doing performing functions that they either hate or that is actually propagating something that's not positive or constructive. And so what we want to, you know, one of the things that we want to try and do is encourage people to do something that they want to do, follow their vocation, but to actually be furnished with the know-how to turn it into a support system.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't have that know-how. It's always better working for yourself than someone else. Always.
Yeah, indeed,
you know,
yeah.
But it does take a... It took me, let's put it this way, it took me a big leap of faith. Even though I'm quite a confident kind of guy, it really took a leap of faith. And I'd been working... It was only in 2003 that I took that leap of faith and started working for myself. And I started working in 1987.
Yeah. Yes, my history is pretty much the same. But it's worth it, isn't it, Simon?
It's the best thing you can. There's only one person that you can rely on, right? Really, truthfully, and it's apart from your mum, and that is yourself.
Yep. I think that's a really good place to leave it, Simon. Thank you very much. It's been a great chat. Thank you. I've been talking with Simon Spaniard, and with Mark Moxon about their website, youandyourcash.com. Plenty of things to get your teeth into there. Thank you so much for joining me on the first Raconteurs News Dr. Rocks radio show, guys.
Absolute pleasure.
It's been a total pleasure, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I'll get it up as a podcast as soon as I can. I'm going to put on some tunes. I'll be back with the people later. Here's the John Preston tribute band playing Ruling Class. I'll be back with you shortly, folks.
Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Race with the Devil by Girl School Air, and previous to that, Mark and Simon giving us some very good reasons for why and how we might choose to run with the other side, as it were. So, we've gone an hour over on this first show. We are aiming to do kind of 9 to 11, but what with the technical difficulties and everything, and it was, I thought, a pretty fascinating conversation. So that's about it for the end of this first show. I'll play a couple of tunes to take us up to midnight. Should be back again next Thursday at 9 o'clock, as usual. I don't really know what I'll be doing. Things tend to unfold as they go along. But I do have several very interesting guests, ar a gwaith, as they say in Welsh, which means on the needles, in production, as it were. So we're we'll be playing up to midnight with Yellow and some Slade, and maybe another wee tune if I can slip one in there. And I'll see you all next week. Thanks to all of you for being out there in the chat box. I'm really encouraged to see so many people. Just a damn shame that being as I was busy broadcasting, I couldn't pay attention to what you all were saying. But excellent. Really enjoyed that. Ta to you all. Ta to raconteursnews.com. And that's it. Till next week. Cheers, folks. Keep it real, eh?